Following is a presentation of Refuge Calvary Chapel Huntington Beach with Pastor Bill Welsh. For more information about our ministry, please visit refugefamily.com.
This is my son, Jeremy. Everybody say hi to Jeremy.
Hello.
How many of you over the last 6 or 7 months have prayed for Jeremy and Joanna? This is his lovely bride, Joanna.
Hi. And,
I know exactly when you guys were married.
Good.
Yes.
And so
hang on. It's the 4th of September.
How do you know that?
Because it's Bethany's birthday.
It is.
It was her 30th birthday too.
That's right.
We stole it from her.
Yes, you did. And what does the B stand for on your hat, Jeremy?
It stands for Ask Jeremy. Obviously.
Yeah. Some of you have heard that. They are in real estate, and Joanna works in a hospital up in Brea. Is it Brea or Fullerton?
Fullerton. Yeah.
Right. So you have heard, I know I've shared with our congregation here the story of the last, it's almost really a year at this point. Mm-hmm. When the crisis began, but I've shared with you what happened back in September of 2024 with Jeremy and with the whole family. But we as a family are just so grateful and to watch this miracle, to watch this work of God to set Jeremy free from alcohol. And I'm introducing this kind of abruptly because I'm not sure. I think we've got enough time to talk about everything that we want to talk about tonight. But how many of you, whether it's you yourself or a family member, or you grew up in a family where there was some form of substance abuse or addiction. How many of you know that personally? Yeah. And that was in our family as well, family that I grew up in. I'm telling you, I don't know that I can look back without remembering a can of beer or a bottle of beer on the table in our home when I grew up. But I love watching God reach into a life and just change it from the inside out. And he's so faithful. We pass these out to you so that you can take these home. They're just a collection of verses that have to do with freedom, with God setting people free. And I put up at the very top, if the Son sets you free, read it with me. If the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. How many of you have ever prayed something that remotely sounds like Jeremiah 17:14? You see it there, the second one down? Read this out loud with me. Oh Lord, if you heal me, I will truly be healed. If you save me, I will truly be truly saved. My praises are for you alone. And we all know that how that happens. There's not one magical prayer that you have to say this prayer this way, but in Romans 13, the next one down, Romans 10:9. Let's read that out loud together too. If you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. It's one of the most important truths to hand over to somebody, to give to somebody. Well, how do I become a Christian? And how do I get saved? And how do I get religion? Well, not really interested in you getting religion, but to establish a relationship with God is that simple. I love how Paul just condensed it. If you'll declare with your mouth, confess it and believe it, that Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you get a new life. Anybody thankful for new life? Amen. So let me introduce you to these two wonderful people. And I've told the story before when Jeremy brought Joanna home to introduce her to us. And I think we had dinner or something. Do we have dinner at the house?
Probably, yeah.
And then said goodbye, and you guys were driving Joanna home, and Joy and I looked at one another, and it was like, this kid, this looks like the one. And I didn't give Jeremy time to get Joanna home, but I called him and he did not answer his phone. And I left the message that said, Jeremy, we love Joanna. And if you don't marry her, I'm going to adopt her.
That's what you thought you said.
That's what I thought I said. That is what I said, but it didn't record every word that I said. Do you remember what you heard?
It just stopped. Well, if you don't marry her, I'm gonna.
Yeah. which is not what I said. But yeah. And when he called me, he said, what was that message all about, Dad? But yeah, it's been you've been such a treasure to our family, Joanna. And introduce everybody to your three boys. Tell them their names and how old are you?
Okay. So our oldest son is Micah. He is 19, graduated high school this last year, is doing a gap year, and he's come to work with me at the hospital. So if you end up at St. Jude and you're being transported around the hospital, that might be Micah. Look for his name badge. Our middle son is Noah. He is just turned 17, and he's a junior at Fullerton High School. And then our youngest son, Owen, is 10, and he is an athlete. I think that's what we could say about Owen. He's an athlete.
He's crazy.
No question.
Is what
he's
he
a
is.
Third child.
Brag a little bit
about all of them. About they're all awesome.
Yeah,
every single one of them is awesome.
They are.
Micah's just a very caring, loving human being. Very athletic. Super great kid. Noah is an incredibly smart, loving, caring. Very smart kid.
Creative.
Very creative.
Yeah.
Love him. Owen is insane. Absolutely insane. But I love him just as much as the other three. He's a little athlete as well.
And Owen is the miniature version of Jeremy. Yeah,
which is why he's insane.
He is insane.
You didn't know that you'd be in our living room today, right? You're going to get to see some pictures too. A little slideshow. It's fantastic.
Yes.
But yeah, Owen's a great little baseball player, great little athlete, and we love him too.
Yeah,
it's so fun watching your kids grow up. They were over on Easter, and when Micah wasn't there, but Noah and Owen were, and I remember their names in order because it's M N O. Yeah, did you guys do that on purpose?
Not on purpose.
Yes,
for me. Yes, but when Noah came in, if I'd seen him on the street, I wouldn't have recognized him. He's changed so much. Mm-hmm. But let me run these pictures by you and introduce you to the family.
Just so you know, he takes a lot of pictures, and he tends to take the ones that that are the worst pictures of us.
Are you concerned about the pictures?
No, I'm not concerned. I'm just letting everyone know.
It's all right, guys. It's all right.
Okay.
That one's a good one, though. I like that picture.
So tonight, it really is a resurrection story. 3 days after we celebrated the resurrection of Jesus, Jesus rose so that you could rise. And Jesus died so that you could live. And he took our weight so that we could roll that weight over on him. But I love what God is doing in you guys. I want you to read this verse with me tonight. As we get into the main part of what we wanted to share, let's read out loud together. Jesus said, "Verily, very true." I'm sorry. I wrote it. Now I can't read it. Jesus said, "Very truly, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed." And look at the place you have, a permanent place in the family of God. And okay, let me move on. So here's the family. There's the boys, and on the left, that was what, 3 years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago?
Yeah.
And the one on the right, September 1st, 4 days before the stroke that Jeremy had. It was one of the last family days that we had down there in the harbor, and who knew what was just 4 days ahead of all of us. And that was in the hospital.
This is what I mean about the photos.
What's wrong with these this photos?
This is what I'm talking about.
So that was in the hospital when Jeremy had gone through 5 days of detox, right?
Six
days of detox. And then he was in the photo on the right. Joanna, you want to explain the photo on the right?
Yeah, so that one was when he was being discharged, and he at that point was not going to come home. And he does not look very happy because at that point was not happy about that choice. But he was going to be taken to a 30-day rehab where he would live there by his friend. So,
and Jeremy, when I showed you this picture, when I looked at myself on my phone, it just was I could see, you know, the expression on your face. It, to me, it looked like it was maybe despair, or it was whatever. I thought it was at that point. But you told me that when you were sitting in that wheelchair, which they made him, you know, go to the truck in the wheelchair, that you said you knew at that point that you were never again going to touch a drop of alcohol, that you knew that you were free.
Yeah, it was right after that when I got into that truck. My friend Neil... that's his truck. He drove me down to the rehab center, and I sat in his truck, and I told him, this is the first time that I can remember ever not craving any sort of substance, specifically alcohol.
Yeah.
And I knew at that moment, while we were in his car, or his truck, leaving the hospital, that I'm not going to touch that stuff again. I'm done with that. And that was the first time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, how long would you say you had a very serious addiction to alcohol?
I would say, well, since probably 2019 is kind of when it got pretty heavy. But our entire marriage pretty much sort of revolved around alcohol. Our marriage didn't revolve around alcohol, but anything that we did revolve around alcohol. Needed to have it to have a good time, or at least I thought I needed to have it to have a good time. But seriously addicted was about 2019. Mm-hmm. And what started that in 2019, there was kind of a crisis in our family. And I'm sure there's been some crises in this room, in some families as well. And I didn't know how to deal with it. You know, I felt like a failure again. And I felt like, I can't do this. So after I found out about this crisis in our house, it was a financial situation that was not good. And I got home thinking I was a failure and didn't want to be on earth anymore. And sat down at my table, and this was probably September, I think, of 2019. So everything happens in September, I guess. But of 2019, sat down at the table, poured myself a gigantic glass of whiskey, and started thinking about how to end it. And I called my friend Neil. Whose truck that is. And I said, dude, I don't know what's going on. I need your help. I need your prayer. And he said, where are you? I said, it doesn't matter where I'm at. And I think probably 3 minutes later, he was at my front door. And he just sat there. He didn't try and fix anything. He just sat there with me. While I was contemplating this. He didn't know that I was contemplating any type of self-harm at that moment. But he just sat there with me, loved me, didn't try and walk through anything or walk me through anything. He was just there to walk through it with me. And then he left, and then I drank that whiskey that I hid in the freezer as soon as he got there. Thought to myself, you know, well, I don't want to shoot myself. I don't want to hang myself. I don't want to do anything super public like that. I've never had a ton of friends. And this kind of seems like a good way to go about it. So I think I'm just going to at least have some fun on my way out. And decided at that moment that was when what I was going to do. I was just going to drink until I couldn't anymore. Not specifically that day, but just because I know it's a long burn. So they say. So I did. And just got incredibly physically addicted. Mentally also addicted to it, to where, you know, I didn't think I could be around people unless I was drinking And I know that goes for a lot of other drugs as well. You feel like you can't be around somebody unless you're doing it. You know, so it was kind of scary. But every day that I would do that, I was thinking, I just want to add to my funeral. I thought about this room, actually. Weird, right? I wanted this room full at my funeral. That's what I thought about. And, you know, that was the day, that day in September, that I really got heavy, deeply into it, mixed with depression, mixed with anxiety, all the other things that we kind of all deal with to an extent. I just didn't have any tools to deal with it. And, you know, booze for me was my way out. It was my way to be free and be who I wanted to be. And I did. I'd made a ton of friends because it's easy to find somebody to drink with, or it's easy to find somebody to use with. No problem. It's kind of hard sometimes to find somebody to just be with. Very hard. But it's there. It's 100% there. But that's where it kind of started.
And Joanna, did you see that getting worse and worse?
I think initially I didn't realize that I had transitioned from staying at home at that point to working again. And so I was not at home as often. And so I didn't really recognize it right away. I could see that it seemed like it was more, but I wasn't seeing it. However, we took a trip in 2022, maybe?
I think it was 23.
Yeah. 2023. And we went to Italy. And it was in Italy that I realized, like, he was having physical symptoms of withdrawals. He was not able to keep the amount of alcohol in his system in order for him physically to be okay. And I was trying to figure out at that point, like, have I been working so much? Like, I haven't realized, like, is he getting, like, Parkinson's? Like, I was trying to figure out, like, is this a health issue or is this something different? And when we got home and he was back in routine, all those symptoms went away. And it dawned on me, this is more than just, like, him drinking to feel better. His body is physically.
And more than recreational. More
right.
Than, yeah. And how was it affecting the family?
It got bad fast at the end. I think that last year, maybe 2 years, basically since I got home, when we got home from that trip, it just took a turn. And there's a lot of unpredictability in the house. Everybody kind of started walking on eggshells all the time. We didn't know, is he going to be happy? Is he going to be sad? Is he going to be awake? Is he going to be sleeping? If there was like something bad that happened at night, we're like, well, like tomorrow morning, maybe everybody will just forget, like he'll forget about anything. So it did start to affect everybody and even the boys. And then I noticed that the boys started, like, they didn't want to bring their friends around the house anymore. They, you know, like those kinds of things that as we always had kids at our house for the longest time, and it was kind of, you know, you started seeing them like withdraw a little bit. And so.
And did you have anybody that you were confiding in or talking it through with?
Not at that time. No, that's why we share our story, because when I looked around, like again, I ran preschools for 20 years. And then I transitioned into HR at a hospital. And when I looked around at people that I worked with or when we went to church on the baseball fields, it didn't seem like anybody else that looked like us was having these kinds of issues. So I didn't really feel like I could talk to anybody.
Yeah. And have you found that to be true or not true on this side of it?
Untrue, yeah. As we started sharing our story, a lot of people have said us too, yeah.
So many people are ashamed to come out with it. And Jeremy, did you during those really, really tough years, did you reach out did you find yourself crying out to God and or praying for his help? And how did you?
Every day I did. I cried out to God and said, help me quit drinking, until you know, kind of not the meat of the story, but the reason why we're here right now is a stroke happened. And, you know, prior to that stroke that happened, it was Mother's Day. And it was going to be my last day of leading worship at the church that I was at. You know, it's kind of funny.
This was last year.
This was last year, Mother's Day of last year, yeah. And, you know, I had been in leadership at that church, which is a great church. And just I knew that I wasn't supposed to be doing that anymore because of the way that I was living my life. And I was stepping down, and this was my last Sunday, and I was really, really nervous. So 3 o'clock in the morning rolls around, and, you know, by this point, I was drinking about 1.75 liters of vodka a day, which is, don't do it. It's don't recommend that at all.
For Americans, that's a half a gallon, right?
It's about a half a gallon. But I started that at
some Americans know the liter system.
Yeah.
I'm just saying,
I don't know why don't we use the metric system? It's so much better anyway. It woke up at 3 o'clock that morning, just nervous to calm everything. And nobody had a clue. Nobody had a clue what was going on because, like Joanna said, I really couldn't function. I couldn't act normal, without it. I would shake a lot and, I wouldn't be able to see if I didn't have, alcohol in my system. And not just a little bit, not just like a little drink here and there, but I needed a lot to start off the day. But, you know, got to church, started going through that set and started, reached over to the keyboard player and I say, hey, this would be really cool if you played da da da, whatever it was. And next thing I know, I'm on the ground looking up and, at a drum set and had no clue what had happened. Had no clue. I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel weird at all. And people standing over me, setting me up, the church where we're at is probably 2 football fields away from where she works. So an ambulance came down from there. That was my first ride in an ambulance. They took me up there. We weren't sure really what was going on. Nobody knew what I had done that morning until toxicology? Is that what it's called?
They did his blood work.
So they did the blood work, and, you know, they found out that I was a 0.3 at that point, which is pretty high. I was 0.294. Doesn't matter the number. It was very high at that point. So got a ride home. They said, basically, he's drunk.
So they didn't admit you in?
They did not admit me that day, and then didn't lead worship the rest of the time. And then fast forward to September 5th. 2024.
To pause on that, yeah, just quickly, because you started sending me some Word documents as you were kind of trying to think through, looking way, way back in your life when you actually started drinking.
Yeah, at that point, you know, coming up to that point, and all the way through up until I think October of last year, I was trying to figure out why. Why am I trying to cover this up? What happened? Where was it? You know, there's chunks of my childhood that I don't remember. Not that anything was bad. Fantastic parents. I have amazing parents. We moved around a lot, that kind of stuff. And it was fantastic. But just trying to figure it out. So I started writing from it based on where we lived, everything that I could remember. And I'm up to, I think, 72 pages of my life. It's really not interesting, guys. So don't worry. You're never going to have to read it.
It's very interesting.
Well, it's interesting to them. Side note, every family get together, I tell them another stupid thing that I did when I was a kid that they had no clue. I highly recommend this for anybody who has a little bit of guilt from their childhood. Definitely do it. It's fun. What are they going to do? Ground me? Take the car away? No.
I'll tell you what it did for me, and I think it's probably reflected in the men, in the it's probably the story on the side of the family that surrounds someone that's struggling. I had no idea, absolutely no idea, that Jeremy was struggling with alcohol. I knew that there was alcohol in their home, but I just had absolutely no indication that it had taken such a grip on him and that it had started so early. That during the time that we lived in Australia.
Yeah, but, yeah. I mean, Australia, being a 12, 13-year-old kid, trying to figure things out, trying to make new friends, just kind of lashing out and breaking into houses and stealing booze from other people and drinking that. And, you know, just, I was an idiot. I was stupid, which is why I don't trust my children.
So you were...
I love you guys.
So you were trying to figure this out in the writing that you were doing, and but you hadn't stopped drinking.
I had not stopped drinking, yeah. And most of that writing was done heavily intoxicated.
And that was May all the way through to...
Yeah, that was before May. That had been probably a year of writing, just trying to figure it out.
Okay, I didn't know that.
And when I started sharing it with you is when I shared it with you, with my father-in-law, and with Neil.
Which another thing I meant to insert at the beginning, these are two preacher's kids.
Yep.
Joanna's dad has been a Foursquare pastor for...
Many decades.
Since
I was born, before I was born, yeah.
So these two preacher's kids found each other in a restaurant.
Yeah, and I was a bartender. She was a hostess.
Yep. So move us down towards September.
Towards September. Yeah. So we already talked about Mother's Day and how that worked. And
so the summer, can I talk a little bit about the summer?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm talking about the summer. So that summer was kind of crazy because we then knew like how bad things had gotten. Me and the boys were kind of eyeing each other like, do you think he needs help? Do you think, yeah, I think he needs help, you know? And the boys were starting to say to me like, Mom, Dad needs help. You need to get him, you know? So those conversations kind of had, it's like trying to ease my way into those conversations. And I can recall after that happened, I made a phone call to his best man in his wedding, in our wedding. And I called him. I knew he loved Jeremy. I hadn't talked to anybody about this yet. And so I thought, well, if I call him, no matter what, I know he's still going to love Jeremy. And so I did. And the conversation with him kind of changed everything for me. And he himself had struggled with alcoholism, and has now been sober for many years. And so I just said, Aaron, this is what's going on. And he said, I knew it. He's not returning my phone calls. He won't answer. Like, I know when Jeremy's struggling because he stops talking to me. And then he just said, Joanna, there's nothing you can do. And so I think this is something that's important because for me, I was spinning my wheels trying to fix his problems. Maybe if I cook a better dinner, maybe if the house is clean, maybe if the kids are quiet, maybe this, maybe that, maybe if we all make him comfortable, then he'll be happy and he won't drink anymore, right? You spin your wheels trying to fix the problem. And Aaron just said, like, he has to hit rock bottom, Joanna. Like, and for some people, that's death. That's their rock bottom. And that changed my prayer from like, God, stop, help, like help him quit drinking alcohol to just, God, help me trust you. Like, whatever's going to happen here, I trust that you love Jeremy more than I love Jeremy. And I trust that you love my kids and you love me more than, I love my kids and Jeremy loves me. That's when it changed from God help me help him to I just have to trust you, God, whatever this looks like. If I'm burying him in 6 months, I just have to trust that that's what your will was for, you know, for this situation. And then Aaron said, and you're the only one that can raise the floor. And so it shifted for me. Rather than trying to fix everything, it was like, I have to start letting things fall through the crack. I have to start making things feel uncomfortable. We have to start saying no. I have to start creating boundaries. And those were the things that I had to start doing, which made it a very difficult summer for everybody. But then we got to our anniversary on
When did we get married?
September 4th. we went to dinner. celebrated 20 years. And the next morning, he took our son to Donuts with Dad's. And then that afternoon, he had the stroke. I was leaving the hospital and got a call from our neighbor that said, Jeremy's acting really weird. I don't know what's going on. This is what he's doing. Of course, our neighbor didn't know what was going on, but I've been waiting for that call for months, you know? And
now anytime Lewis calls her.
Like, Lewis, you're not allowed to call me.
What happened now?
Yeah. I was leaving the hospital. We live like 5 minutes from the hospital. So I said, I'll be home in 5 minutes, call the ambulance, get, you know. But that's, you know, we kind of suffered through that summer, and then he had the stroke.
Yeah, and that's when it happened. Donuts with Dad, or Donuts with a loved one, whatever they call it.
Dear One Donuts.
Dear One Donuts with a dear one. That's hard to say sometimes. But yeah, having that was another morning, just a morning of just, I'm a horrible dad, number one. Had woken up early that morning too, had gone through, by this point we were having, school was done. Everyone got together at a neighbor's house two doors down from my house that had a pool. It was about 102 degrees that day, so we went and jumped in the pool. Nobody knew, again, that I had been partaking on my own that day. And I had stood up. I was in the pool. All the kids are playing. Everybody, there's, you know, everyone's around. I had stood up to go back to my house to grab another drink. And Lewis, which is our neighbor, was standing directly next to me. And next thing I remember is waking up kind of in his arms. And, you know, I'm not a small guy. Lewis is a very strong guy. He caught me. Thankfully, he caught me, saved me from, you know, hitting my head or falling into a pool or drowning or something like that. And that's when you got the phone call from Lewis. And then, you know, from that moment on, I saw all my entire family, except for Micah. Micah wasn't there at that point. But I saw everyone looking at me scared. I saw Joanna looking at me angry. And then my middle son, Noah, I was refusing help. I was refusing to go to the hospital. I didn't want to do that. I knew what was going on. I just needed to go sleep this one off, as they say. And everyone's like, no, you need to go to the hospital. You need to go. And Noah, Noah's awesome. Standing in front of me, and he says, Dad, you need to go. And I was like, fine, I'll go for you.
He wasn't going to go for me.
No.
But he went for Noah.
No, I wasn't going to go for you. But then they took me to the hospital. You know, same idea. Tests, all of that stuff. And then 6 days in the hospital. What I didn't know was Joanna, with her pool at the hospital, told them, you need to keep him. He's not getting released this time. So we did. They did. They kept me. They did, you know, all the blood tests and all that kind of stuff. And at that point, my blood alcohol content was a 0.35. And doing my own tests, later on, just to see what that one more drink that I was going to get would have done to me based on metabolism and, you know, all the science stuff that goes along with it. That one drink, the way that I would have poured it, would have probably been my last drink of anything ever in my life. From what I'm told, I'm not a doctor. I don't know.
And didn't the doctor confirm that?
Yes.
Yeah.
0.4 is death or incredible brain damage that you don't come back from. So at, you know, after going through the hospital and going through, I don't know if anybody in here has gone through withdrawals from alcohol, but there's a thing called delirium tremens that you hallucinate and become something other than who you are while you're coming off of this poison. So I was hallucinating. I was in a different place. And this is a hospital that Joanna works at. Joanna works in HR in this hospital, and I apparently was pretty unpopular for a few days there.
When we came to see you, you were a different person than I'd ever seen.
I had to be restrained.
Your responses. And
yeah, I had to be restrained. I was fighting. I thought they were trying to kill me. I got out of my restraints. I fell. I had to get MRIs, that kind of stuff. And, you know, through all of this hallucination, eventually, you know, the drugs that they were giving me to calm it just made everything worse. So they had to give me something a little bit stronger. A nurse, an old school nurse, as she said, we need to go old school with this guy. Yeah. And they went, they gave me something strong and just knocked me out. But during all that time, I was hallucinating. I was somewhere else. But as soon as they gave me that, as soon as they knocked me out, I kind of went into a dream. And the dream was, I don't know if it's profound. I don't know if it was a vision. I don't know what it was. But I remember being in a cave by myself, a dark cave, kind of dark up here, and then went to orange. And there was rock formations around me inside the cave. And outside the cave, there was a giant, like, land bridge that everybody that I knew was out there singing. And they were singing praises to God. And I'm just looking out. In all of this, I didn't see Jesus. I didn't see God. But I knew that I was in his presence. And I said, either take me or use me. I just can't do this. And then I woke up. And I remember that. And that actually was the moment that I knew, I'm done. I know I can't do this anymore.
So then, that point of just surrender?
Yeah, it was a point of surrender. And then, you know, being in the hospital, Joanna making some tough decisions. I did give her full authority to make tough decisions on my behalf. So being there for 6 days, I had to learn how to walk again. It wasn't just a bad hangover. I had to learn how to walk again while I was in the hospital. Thankfully, it was a small stroke, TIA. I don't know what the TI or A stands for, but it's a small stroke. And thankfully, I've fully recovered from all of that. There are some lingering things that are still happening physically, but we're working through all that stuff. But at the end of that 6 days, when I was really excited to go home, I was really excited to go and take a shower in my own home. you know, without little beeps and all that kind of stuff. What was odd, though, you know, it's a lonely place to be. And you find comfort in weird places, weird things. When I was there for 6 days, I had a cuff on my arm to take my blood pressure. Every time that thing went on, I felt like I was loved. It was weird. I don't know why. Kind of crave it even still.
Love? You felt loved?
Can we get one of those at home?
No.
No?
No.
It seems like anyway, it just, you know, the cuff for your blood pressure.
And you were being loved there.
I was, yeah.
You've got just a couple of shots I want you to see. Those are Jeremy's sisters, Bethany, Shannon.
Shannon looks angry at me.
And Starlin.
So does Starlin.
Well, the other picture of Starlin was a weirder face on her, so I had to put that one up there. But
those are nice socks, too.
These were the support team that came around him. The day that we went, Joy and I went, first one up there, the man sitting in the chair, what's his name?
His name is Cornell.
And he's from Romania. Mm-hmm. And he's a son of a Pentecostal preacher from Romania. And when we were about to leave, when Cornell came in, and you could tell there was just something, a connection between Jeremy and Cornell that spoke to me about just the, and I knew with Neil as well, the guy on the right there, and that's
Aaron,
his buddy from, they used to work together over at the Macaroni Grill. But when the friends came around, and how many of you that have walked through something hard like this, that it was just the commonality you had with a friend, mm-hmm. someone that wasn't, they weren't going to kick you to the curb. They were going to walk through whatever you were going through. And they were going to be there with you. And they weren't a specialist. They weren't a licensed counselor. Not that licensed counselors are bad. You need that at times. But they were just a support team of people that were like that cuff on your arm, mm-hmm. that were loving you. And it was hard when Joy and I went into the hospital, and and saw our son there. And it, when he was still in the stages where there was obviously some hallucination and it just wasn't him yet, to watch the family come around and the sisters come and just to be with him. I just knew when we walked out of the room that day to go where we had to go, we had gathered around and prayed for Jeremy first. And then Joanna and Joy and I came out of the room. We were getting ready to go home. And I turned around, and what I saw was the other way. I saw that picture there on the left, where Cornell grabbed the chair and pulled it up close to his friend and just listened to Jeremy. There was somebody there that was listening to whatever he had to say and was praying for him. And when Cornell, the son of the Pentecostal preacher, started praying for my son, it was God. He's in great hands. He's in your hands, and he's surrounded by people that love you and a wife that loves you. That, you know, and Joanna, you were going through so much of this alone. And you, if you want to talk a little bit about that thing called codependency, yeah, and the importance of getting people on your team, people you can talk through.
Yeah. Talk a little bit. Well, I think, you know, prior to the stroke in that summer, I started feeling like I was going crazy. That's what happens, you know. And he had agreed to not go to get, like, treatment, but he had started seeing a counselor. Mm-hmm. And he kind of, like, tricked me to go see the counselor. He said, I need you to drive me to the counselor.
That was not a trick. The truth is, I couldn't see that day because I was trying to stop drinking that day.
Okay.
So, and I could not see. I couldn't drive.
So he called me from work.
I could drive drunk, but I couldn't drive that day sober.
Couldn't drive sober, yeah. So he called me at work and said, I need a drive. So I drove, and when I got there, the counselor said, hey, why don't you join us? And I was like, oh, I think he's the one that needs to talk to you. You know, I'm probably fine. Well, so we talked a little bit, and then a couple weeks later, I was like, I need to go back. I have problems too. And so I started realizing that, you know, while Jeremy was struggling with alcoholism, I had been struggling my whole life with codependency. And those two things just played hand in hand. And that whole idea of just really trying to help him so much that it actually encouraged his drinking and it encouraged his addiction. And so I needed to stop doing those things. And so anyway, I think our first trip, the counselor looked at me and he was like, hey, have you ever heard of codependency? Have you ever read this book? And he gave me the name of a book to read. And as I started reading it, I was like, oh man, yes. Okay, I'm not going crazy. This is a thing. And it started validating all these feelings inside of me. And that's where my healing process started. But I really couldn't or wouldn't have ever found that if I would have just kept it to myself. Because I think part of what I was trying to do was everything's fine here, nothing to see. Like, see, we have our perfect three kids and we have our perfect family. And yeah, we're a little messy, but like nothing to see, you know, not trying to make any waves. But as soon as you speak it and as soon as you share it, I feel like that is when I started getting the confidence and really the courage to be stronger, to create boundaries, to say no, to, you know, all those kinds of things. And so I just would encourage you, if you love somebody who is struggling and you find yourself feeling a little crazy and you're kind of doing crazy things, you're not crazy, but maybe you're codependent and maybe you should get some help in that way.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. And we are, man, this time has flown. But we're not quite done, because I want you guys to talk about where you are, how this whole crisis you guys walked through, this journey you're on, has affected your relationship with God. Jeremy, you started sharing the word with me as you were reading through the Psalms and all that, and how has it impacted your relationship with God? But I want to read these two comments that I asked the two older boys over the last couple of days. I asked Noah on Easter when we were together, and I asked Micah yesterday. But here's what Noah said about, I asked him, what change do you see in your dad? And he said, I think that ever since he's gotten sober, I've seen so much more of his personality come out again, and I feel like he really has been more happy and fulfilled, in my opinion.
In my opinion.
And I can just hear Noah saying that. And this is what Micah said today. And these are two very tenderhearted kids, too. They're just amazing. He said, my dad has been a lot more active and present. He's been helping out more around the house and hasn't been getting mad so easily, and overall just a better person. And that's your boy saying that.
Yeah.
And there was one other thing, and it just has escaped me. It was what you put up on your social media account. And I want them to tell you how you can follow them, too, because there's a decision that you guys made about 3-4 months ago that you went public. I mean, social media public with your story and telling the whole story. And then I'm watching this thing, and at the end you're saying, and if any of you are just looking for somebody to talk to, mm-hmm. and you said, we're not counselors, we're not this, we're not that, but if you're looking for hope, here's my phone number. And you gave my phone number out.
Did you get some calls?
You gave your phone number out over the World Wide Web, yeah. Both of you.
The whole internet.
And I got a hold of you and said, are you sure you want to do that? And you said, we just want to be vessels of, you didn't put it that way, we just want to be an avenue of hope, mm-hmm. for people that are going through that. And I love the compassion that you guys are showing to people that are hurting. And so I said, well, if you're going to go public, would you like to go on the radio with me for, was it 6 weeks or 8 weeks we did that?
I think it was six.
6 weeks. And we're going to get that packaged up so you can hear all six episodes of what we did on the Tuesday Refuge Radio program. But how has it impacted? Where is your relationship with the Lord now? And what would you say you're most thankful for? Obviously the sobriety, but... I'm sorry.
You go.
I introduced it. And what you put up on your social media account with Jeremy was at the ballpark. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and share that. That was just...
Yeah, I mean, I think nothing... We don't take anything for granted anymore. You know, every holiday, everything. And so we're in the middle of baseball season. And last baseball season, Jeremy was still drinking very heavily and trying his best to be present, but... really wasn't able to be. His body was there, but maybe not his mind. And then last night, Owen was warming up to pitch, and he's helping coach this season. And Jeremy was out there catching his warm-up pitches. And I can't even remember exactly what I said, but just the idea that, you know, there's a lot of things to be thankful for this right now. But, you know, these moments with our kids that I didn't know if I would have already buried him. And instead, I get to watch him warm up Owen pitching. Yeah.
What you wrote was this. It's a video of Jeremy tossing the ball back and forth with Owen, and says, there's 10,000 reasons for my husband to stay sober, but warming up our son for pitching at his game is right near the top.
Yeah.
And how much more do you just... appreciate being the dad and the husband that you are now.
Yeah, it's amazing. I ask the boys every probably 2 weeks, just, hey, do you notice a difference? And they all say, yes, I do. I'm like, what do you notice that's different? Everything that you said.
Yeah.
So that's really cool to get to do that. But on that post too, Joanna mentioned, what if? Mm. The what ifs, all the what ifs. Yeah. What if I was gone?
Yeah.
What if I wasn't there for my boys and I wasn't there for Joanna? What if also on the other side, the scared parts, what if Joanna didn't make those decisions for me?
Yeah.
Which I was mad. I was very mad about.
That's a good catch right there.
You know, I mean, I can finish. I got more.
That wouldn't be horrible, but that was a good catch.
But I was very upset. But what if she didn't make those decisions, those choices, as angry as I was about them and as lonely as I felt in those? We had to. I had to do that. And we're not sharing this to give you a, we've come through, woe is us, and look where we're at now. We're sharing all this because there are so many people in this room even right now that are struggling, not just with alcohol, with addiction of any sort, with not feeling enough. And you are. We're here to tell you that, and to bring hope, and to be an ear. And there was somebody that came up to us. I have no idea where she is, but she came up to us outside of that door. She said, "Are you Jeremy?" And I said, "Yeah, Jeremy." She said, "I'm 3 days sober." That's huge.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I'm not here every week. You guys are. Get around her. Every day is a win. Every minute is a win. And we can't do that alone.
Amen.
We have to be there non-judgmentally,
amen,
consistently, for whoever it is. And sometimes, I'm not saying that this is the case here. Sometimes it's the guy that's leading worship. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the guy that's preaching. Sometimes it's a leader within the church. Sometimes it's a leader at work. Sometimes it's, most times it's somebody you don't suspect. Be there. We're all looking for a buddy, every single one of us.
Yeah.
Even the strongest one that says, "I don't need somebody," that's a lie.
Yeah.
We need to be there consistently, and we cannot do it alone. That's why we're doing this. That's why we're consistently out doing this and talking to people and living it too.
Yeah,
I had an opportunity to go to a hospital and sit down at the bedside of somebody in the exact same position that I was in. And now we're friends. Mm. And we get to keep each other accountable for this. And, you know, if you are struggling with something like this and it's a group of some sort is what you need, go to an AA. Go to a recovery. There's recovery here as well. More importantly, find a friend or be a friend to somebody that you think can help.
Is that Friday night or Thursday night?
Monday and Friday.
Friday night back in the junior high room.
Yeah, you need to get around people that love you, that are willing to say the hard things to you. A lot of us that are addicted, I guess, we're pretty strong people and we don't like to hear the hard thing. But once you have a relationship with somebody, you can have those hard conversations.
Yeah.
And it's a give and take. It's not just a give. And when you're going through all of this stuff, we can't live in that victim mentality of why we're covering things up. We can understand what we're doing, get the help that we need, and then move on and be the help for somebody else. But we've got to keep on going. It's tough, but it is incredibly rewarding on this side of it. And it's an everyday decision that we all have to make to whatever it is that you might be going through or struggling with. It's an everyday decision to get up. And while I was gone, while I was doing all of this stuff, I never had a bad relationship with God. I always knew that God was right there with me consistently. But it wasn't until I didn't have a half a gallon of vodka in front of me that I had to go to something else. So I started making omelets at 4 o'clock in the morning and reading the Bible. I started with Psalms and it depressed me. It just whines a lot.
It's just honest. It's just honest. There's days,
and that's not what I needed to hear.
Like that.
So, but I got into Proverbs, started reading a proverb every day, you know, a chapter of Proverbs, and moved through pretty much the whole Bible now, and starting the day and starting with something different that's better for me. And now I'm able to go out and do the things that I love. You know, like for 2 years, I didn't ride a mountain bike, which was something I loved, yeah, just because I would rather have done something else. And then I started riding my bike again quite a
and
bit.
And you've been riding with the boys too.
Yeah, look at this. I fell yesterday.
Yeah, I saw that. That was wanting pretty an good.
I fell thinking some older people needed help, and they said, no, we were just waving. I was like, are you okay? They're Jeremy, like, yeah. I'm like, you okay?
There was something that, and I can't remember where it came from, if it was something somebody said to you or something you realized that, and it just changed your perspective. You've shared this a lot, but I'll give you the beginning of the phrase. That is
something that I realized. I realized this when I was at a family function. So for a long time, family functions, and I'm surprised you guys didn't know that I wasn't sober at those for the last long time. But they were tough. Me and another family member, we had a little bit of, you know, family members getting arguments, right? And we don't like each other for a time. And it happens. It's family. It's life. Whatever. So any of these family functions were very, very tough for me. Very tough. And I was just not there. And I was not there on purpose. I was physically there. I was mentally not there. And I would avoid this person and their family. But after the stroke, realizing, like, it's gone like that. Your life is gone quick. And you don't even know it. After all of this, I realized my sister means a lot to me. And this doesn't matter. This thing that we're fighting about doesn't matter. This is dumb. I'm over it. I'm done. And as soon as I came to that realization, family functions were fun. Not just for me, because it wasn't fun for anyone else either. It was tough. It was a fight to just be and, like, let's be and coexist.
I thought they were kind of nice.
Well,
you didn't know everything.
You did a great job. But once I realized that, I realized, and this is not a pat on my own back, I realized how big of a deal I am in my family. And that's not just to say me, how big of a deal you are in your family, even when you don't feel like it. If you're going through something, your family, your entire family, not just your sons or your daughters or your spouse, your entire family feels it. And it's horrible. And I know that's the last thing that any of us want to do to our family. We don't want to hurt them, even though they've hurt us, right? But we've got to live in forgiveness. Amen. We have to live in forgiveness. And if we can do that, life is good, and we are a big deal. No matter what you do for work, no matter what you drive, no matter where you are, your status, where you live, you're a big deal. Amen. And you will be missed.
Amen.
If you're gone.
Yeah. And tonight we're going to pray, and if there's anybody here this evening that this is really hitting a soft spot in your heart, your life, your family, and you want prayer, and this is just the first step, because the other steps of getting accountable to one another, getting those, responding to friends that have been trying to reach out and trying to help you. Those other steps need to be taken. Getting in the Word yourself and speaking your heart empty before God, telling Him everything that's in your heart, and having people that you can walk with and you can stay accountable to. All those things are absolutely essential as well. But it starts by crying out to God, like Jeremy and Joanna were doing. Lord, help us. And even the repetitive prayer of, Lord, help me to conquer alcohol. Please take this away from me. And that those prayers of desperation He hears. I was what came to mind for me tonight when we were in worship is when the story when Jesus is it's in Matthew chapter 8, and He comes down from the mountain. Great multitudes are following Him, and it says, and behold, a leper came and worshipped Him and said, Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean. He looks at Jesus and he says, Jesus, if you're willing, you can change my life. You can take this away from me. And a leper was, they were loners. Lepers were loners. The only people they hung out with were lepers. And he's so desperate. And he says, Lord, you can take this from me. And immediately, Jesus says, it says that Jesus then put out his hand and he touched him. You don't touch lepers. He touched him. And he said, I would love to hear the playback of this in heaven, how Jesus said to him, oh, I am willing. I'm so willing. Be clean. I don't picture Jesus just reaching out and just barely touching him with his fingertip. I picture Jesus with his arms wrapped around him, and he says, I am willing. And make sure that you're willing to reach out to somebody that's struggling, because look around you before you leave and recognize everybody you see is going through something. Mm-hmm. Everybody's carrying something. And we have to carry those things together. Drop the church face with one another, and let's just be real with each other. And is there anything in closing that you guys wanted to say? I'm just so thankful you guys are willing to come tonight and share with us.
I think, again, just sticking with why we're doing this is there's hope, especially when you feel hopeless. There is hope. There is somebody who's willing to listen. And for those that are willing to listen, they don't need you to fix anything because you can't. Just listen and just be there and know that in some cases they're going to fail. They might fail multiple times, but continue to listen, continue to love, because there's nothing that you can do except for be there for somebody. You can't force somebody to change their mind, but you can be the person that when you're the other person's free, you can be the one that they look back and go, that guy was with me the entire time. Or that girl, she was with me the entire time and didn't judge me, just simply loved me.
Would you say it's important to reach out to the spouse too, or to the other family members, and let them know we're here for you as well?
Yeah, that was important, that people were also reaching out to us, because the isolation also continues to the family. So yeah, definitely whatever you can do to support the family as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask, why don't we all stand together? And if there's anybody here tonight that is either it's in your family, maybe it's you personally, maybe it's a family member that is here, a family member that's not here. And if any of you have somebody that if you want prayer over this tonight, I'm just going to ask you let's do the church thing. And if you'd like prayer for that, I want to just pray over us as a group. Would you come forward up to the front, and we'll circle around you and we'll pray. If it's somebody you know, or if it's you, and we're not going to interrogate anybody tonight, we're just going to stand in support as a family. So if there's anybody this evening that would just like us to pray over your family, and maybe it's you. Yeah.
This has been a presentation of Refuge Calvary Chapel Huntington Beach with Pastor Bill Welsh. For more information about our ministry, please visit refugefamily.com or call 714-891-9495.